tonight for Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John in Acts show what remarkable fact about the resurrection toward which everybody had looked forward, which was to be the great climax of human history. When it actually happened, what was the reaction of most of the people to it, including members of the church, including apostles? Did they say, hooray, hooray, it's happened at last? When somebody told them about it, what did they say? Were you here the last time? Were you? Oh, well, that shows how badly I delivered. Well, you'd expect them to say, like dancing in the streets, you know. They expect that very same sort of thing. It's like when in 1968 they discovered the original version of the first vision, an older text, far older than any other, goes back to way 3132. I told the person who found it that there would be dancing in the streets when that thing got out. And there was no dancing in the streets. They shoved it under the rug. They didn't want to have anything to do with it. It was written in the handwriting of Frederick G. Williams at the dictation of the prophet Joseph when he was 26 years old. By far the fullest and best account we have of the first vision. We never even acknowledged it existed. It's a strange thing. Well, the same thing happens here in the New Testament. How did the people first accept the news the Lord had risen? How did they accept it? With open arms? With joy? They wouldn't believe it. Even the apostles wouldn't believe it. When the Marys told the apostles to see him, they said, you're Leros, you're crazy. No, nobody would believe it. And Mary, did she instantly recognize the Lord when she saw him? No, she thought he was the gardener. Told him to get to work. Didn't do that. But no, it was just that commonplace, that ordinary, not the sort of thing people would suggest. So then we went on to about the early Christians. The first church after the first, second century, the second century was the century of Gnosticism. Gnosticism spiritualized everything. Everything is spiritual in Gnosticism. So they were absolutely against physical resurrection, and physical creation were an abomination in their book. They wanted nothing to do with it. And they were most of the church, the Gnostics. But still, what about these other Christians? We talked about the apostolic fathers. Remember, they were the seven first to follow. Now we have a much richer literature of very early writings that talk about the resurrection and so forth. But what is the main problem that these apostolic fathers have? There were seven of them. There was Clement, and there was Polycarp, and there was Ignatius. And the second Clement, and they all had the same thing. Not only was the church falling away, but the one thing the people would not believe was what? Yeah, easy to guess by now, isn't it? Brother Hansen? Is Brother Hansen here? Yes. It's easy to guess. How did the people take the... Remember, we just quoted from one where... especially from Clement and then from Ignatius of Antioch. He says, if there is no resurrection from the dead, why am I going to Rome to be put to death? He says, none of you say there's a resurrection from the dead. You don't really believe it. You believe it came in spirit. And of course, this has greatly strengthened the position of later church historians and so forth, excusing themselves for believing such a thing, because then we get to the doctors of the church. Who were the... is Brother Hart here? Brother Hart? Yeah, Brother Hart. You don't know who are called the doctors of the church. That's a technical term. I'm going to have to tell you, I'm afraid. There were four Greek doctors and four Latin doctors, and they set the course of all Christian theology forever after. They all got it from Origen, but Origen wasn't accepted as a doctor of the church. He came earlier in Alexandria because he preached too much of the old teachings. He says, This is what's taught today, he's fond of saying, but what the brethren taught in the early days, the brethren taught something different. So he didn't get rated as a doctor of the church. No, the four doctors of the church would include Augustine and Jerome, whom I mentioned last time, both of whom said that the idea of the resurrection was out of the question. We would dissolve and into the nothing from which we came and so forth. Augustine saying that it's utterly inconceivable there should be a physical resurrection, that would be an abomination, and so forth. And with them, there was, along with that, was The other group was Gregory and Hickman. Was Gregory and Jerome and Gregory and Ambrose. They were the four great Roman doctors. And the Greek doctors were Athanasius, Gregory of Nyssen and his cousin, Gregorius Thaumaturgus, Basil and Basil. So those eight men set the tone, and they were. What did they speak? Did they teach about Revelation? Did we talk about them? What they taught about the doctrine of the Church? Yes, we quoted just enough from Augustine and his friend, his close personal. Well, they're born 15 years apart. Gregory, Jerome, and what they had to say about it. No resurrection. Jerome says, remember. We'll have to be resurrected because the gospel says so, and then we'll melt and very promptly become the nothing from which we came. And then who would come after them? Well, who comes after them, we'll have to ask about the modern clergy. They come from them. Now, the modern clergy don't like it at all either, but again, they feel bound to say something about it. And this is where the Book of Mormon becomes very important here. Let's hear some things. Now, I've quoted every one of the number one New Testament scholars of the time when this was written. It was written in 1966. It's been in Holland, in the Vigilia Christiani. For many scholars, the possibility of such an event as the Lord coming and preaching the theme of the 40 days, he actually came. And he preached. And that's a long time to be coming all the time. First he came the 3 days in the Book of Mormon, then he preaches off and on, it says, for 40 days. He comes and camps with them, spends visits with them. That's plenty of time to teach them all this time. But did he really come? And everybody says, no, he didn't. So here, J.G. Davis, the grand old man this is the other Davis, D.W. No, this is Davis. He is the foremost English scholar of Old Testament. He edited this huge book on the subject. Everybody contributed to it. He's been here at Provo a couple of times. He's written me some letters about Mormonism and so forth, and we corresponded. But he is the grand old man, and he says in his work, the title of the work is He Ascended to Heaven. We are bound to conclude that such an occurrence is not only improbable, but impossible. So that's his view of the resurrection. So he writes a book on the resurrection. We are bound to conclude that such an occurrence is not only improbable, but impossible. It's not even be discussed. For others, such things are tolerable only as myths. M.J. Suggs, who is a big believer, and he quotes the great Reinhold Niebuhr when he says, it's to be taken seriously, but not literally. Take it seriously as a spiritual thing, I suppose, but not literally. And D.F. Strauss, you know, great Strauss, Leben Jesu, that caused an absolute sensation at the beginning of the turn of the century. And D.F. Strauss says, das können wir zwar nicht zusammendenken. We just can't conceive of it. Utterly inconceivable for us, but the evangelists could think of such a thing. The evangelists were able to believe such things, but we, enlightened people today, are not. That's the thing Jerome says a lot. That's the thing a Christian writing of the 4th century called the Octavius has a lot to say about. That was all right for those, and Jerome especially, see, for those early primitive Christians, that was fine. They were naive. They believed such things. But, of course, today we're more educated, and we don't accept that stuff. And this became Christian doctrine. Aristotle would be more. And then here says Joachim Jeremias, who's lived in Palestine most of his life and who was a great scholar, he says, we can only know Jesus clad in the garb of myth. The stories we read about Jesus are nothing but myths, wishful thinking after he had gone. So this is the way the Christian world takes these things. So you see why the Book of Mormon is a very necessary curative to these things, to set back the balance. Yes, brother?
But these men and the eight men that you were talking about earlier, be the ones that the Book of Mormon was talking about, the take the plain and precious things?
No, that comes earlier. That comes way back earlier. Now, this is a thing. Today, you see, ever since the Dead Sea Scrolls started coming out, then we found the Nag Hammadi Library. They're getting very much into the old documents, older than they've ever had before, you see. And whenever you find one, it's almost bound to bear the title, The Secret Teachings Which the Lord Gave to the Apostles After the Resurrection. The point is, you see, we're told that he gave them the teaching, but we're not told a word of what it was. In the New Testament. Now, Book of Mormon tells us what it is. It gives us the teaching, and so, which is more than just what he gave them while he was still with them, as he says. Well, some are frank to admit that they simply do not like the story. And Paul Scherer says, half of it I like, half of it I don't. If you like a story, it's true. If you don't, you don't have to accept it. And another one says, M.E. Dahl, the great Danish scholar, who was the foremost in, among the Danish scholars in this, he says, and there's a work called The Resurrection of the Body. Now, that's the name of the book. So he says about it, the point is, do we or do we not like the answers? If we like the idea, he was resurrected. If we don't like it, then he wasn't resurrected. It's all up to us, as if it was that. So this is the way they talk. It's astonishing how many writers on the resurrection passed the 40-day interval, that part of it, in studied silence. Gives some good examples. Severus of Antioch, in his exhaustive treatise on the resurrection, never mentions the 40-day mission. And Bousset, the most eminent scholar to write on the apostasy in Germany at the end of the 19th century, W. Bousset, like M.E. Dahl and Foulkes Jackson and Kearsop Lake, we knew him, he's the foremost there at Chicago, you know, and Foulkes Jackson, commentary on the Exodus, and Gresser, in all their long surveys, they all write on the subject and never mention once, never mention the 40-day mission of Christ. In fact, if he came back and preached. And indeed, churchmen since Clement and Origen have employed all the arts of rhetoric and logic to evade this crass literalism. Schmidt has talked about that. He can't stand it. It is claimed that the story is insufficient. They do everything to excuse themselves. They claim that the story is insufficiently attested. That's what J.G. Dagerton and Gilmore and others do. Or that the language or the thought forms of the ancients elude us. And Dahl says here, it's unlikely that the Apostle Paul's logic bore any resemblance to ours, whether deductive or inductive. When he talks, it's a language we don't understand. His logic is completely out. We don't have his logic at all. When he calls it black, he could mean white as far as we're concerned. So what good are the scriptures in that case? They bear no resemblance to our type of thinking. And or that the writers themselves were confused in maintaining that the flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom while asserting the very opposite, says it's right in the doctrine of the resurrection. Well, of course, the blood is the life. The blood is the mortality. The blood is the corruptible. Of course, flesh and blood can't, but the Lord doesn't say flesh and blood doth. Spirit does not have flesh and blood, as you see me have. He says the spirit has not flesh and bone, as you see me have, which is something very different. You see. But that is none other than Kearsop Lake saying that. And he says both John and Paul were hopelessly confused about the post-resurrectional reality. Now, the apostles were on the spot, but they were hopelessly confused. Well, then where are we going to be? Yet even those who accept the 40-day ministry are at a loss to explain it. What happened? Plainly the key's missing. This is the point, you see. When serious commentators can describe the event as a mere example of condescension and friendship. He just came back to be friendly, you see. Well, he was friendly. By one who had more urgent business elsewhere. Another said a magnanimous recompense for the 40 hours of anguish occasioned by the Lord's absence. He made them suffer 40 hours when he was away. So to make up for it, he stayed 40 days with them. Well, these are pure sentimental speculation. And others says, it says, R.F. Hancock in the Hebrews Journal says, it was 40 odd days of frustration and inaction. The apostles didn't know what to do. The Lord didn't know what. They just sat around and say, what do we do now? 40 days of frustration and inaction. Or as strategic and psychological holding back of forces for a more effective charge to the enemy. Let's build up a while and then really overrun them. It is often claimed that a full 40 days were necessary to demonstrate the reality of the resurrectional flesh. They were so reluctant to believe the flesh could be resurrected that he had to come back for 40 days and show them that he was in the flesh and then cease to be. For after all, 40 seconds was enough to convince Thomas. We're told that the apostles had to overlearn their lessons in order to persuade an over-skeptical world. They're described as a weaning process to draw the disciples gradually away from undue attachment to each other or to the person of the Lord, lest they be too upset at his departure, as they were upset. Or strangest of all, to wean their minds away from corporeal, physical concepts to pure realms of disembodied intellect. This is why he came 40 days eating with them, talking with them, saying, a spirit hath not flesh and blood as you see me have. And he called for fish and honeycomb, and he ate it before them so they'd know. Because feeling and seeing hadn't been enough, he says, if that's not enough. But the real reason was to prove to him that he was a spirit. It took 40 days to prove he was a spirit after he said he wasn't. Well, In short, if anything like the great 40 days occurred, the enormous portent of it, which Luke puts at the very root of the Christian faith, quite escapes commentators who viewed it as an odd and rather interesting interlude, but admit that in the end, we do not know what Christ did or said during the 40 days. We can only suggest it. Now, that's interesting, because then their eyes were open, and then they were able to go forth on their missions, but we don't have a word of what he told them, you see. Here's Jacquier says, just what does a spiritual body do? We don't know. He's right. We can only reverently conjecture. Nowhere set forth in the scriptures. It's impertinent to require and overbold to specify, says Alapide, who is the foremost Catholic commentator on the whole shebang. He says, Alapide, he says, we find this. Nowhere in the scripture do we find out what the nature of Christ's body really was. It's impertinent to inquire and overbold to specify what it is. And so we go. Everybody's at sea. We have only the opening words of the Lord's discourse. And what does he say? Oh, fools and slow of heart, not to believe all the prophets have said. That you can't understand. You're stupid. And then it says, beginning with Moses and all the scriptures, he explained it all to them, and then their eyes were open. We were not given a word of the great sermon he gave to them, then or after. None of that. See why we need the Book of Mormon here, why we need a fifth gospel here. No, not a word of there. Declaring how badly the disciples need the instruction, Luke 24, 25 to 27. And nothing of this is preserved in the canon, we're told in the 45th verse. These writings take the position of conscious resistance to the rising tide of skepticism regarding the reality of the resurrection, and so it goes on. So now we're going to another aspect of it. And the teaching was never designed to be popular. It never went and was junked by the church in a great hurry. So, next question there. Where do we stand today? This is the point. Where are we today on the resurrection, the Christian churches and so forth? Well, again, we have just been quoting from modern doctors on that. You don't have to go very far there. Oh, but we can't decide unless we take contemporary science into account. Now, what they did when they rejected it, see, who did they take for their guide? Well, they took Aristotle for their guide. He became the scientific, he became the cornerstone of the church. You had to adapt the scriptures to Aristotle, not Aristotle to the scriptures. Aristotle was final as far as that goes, and he still was. In scholastic philosophy, he is the Thomas. There are those who try to who deny it now. They realize that they've gone too far. But all for 1,000 years, Aristotle was the master. Those who know him, he was the keynote in theology. We don't need to go into that now, but we're going to talk about ours. They wanted to make it scientific, and the church has always, as it was Whitehead, Alfred North Whitehead, who said the Christian church has always, its whole course has been one long, humiliating retreat as they make one condescension, adaption after another. They do the adapting. They don't adopt the scriptures to themselves. But they say one long humiliating retreat as they adapt and go along. And so, how do we adapt here? Now, this is serious. It's become serious recently, and we're talking about it this way. What is the scientific mood today regarding these things? Sure, we have some scientists here. Brother Havens, what is the scientific mood today? Is it positivist? Do you know what positivism is, don't you? There was a cult of positivism founded in France in the middle of the 19th century, and it spread very rapidly. Positivism was just what you could know, what you could see, you could feel, but absolutely sure. That was science as science, just pure science. Everything else is nonsense. See? You see lots of science fiction books. People write about that way still. And like all the others, it sort of faded on the branch, on the vine. And an interesting thing that most of the old chapels of the, it was like scientism, you know, like scientism, of the positivists were bought over by the church. The church got them very easily because it collapsed with Cuvier's death, but their leader. And so the Mormon church was able to take over a lot of nice chapels from them. But no, that's positive. And a positivist is just what you know, and you're the scientist. It's obvious, it's true, and so forth. Well, is that the thing today? Can you trust your senses at all? Well, that's the whole thing when it comes into things like quantum physics and things like that. No, quantum physics seems to adapt itself to modern revelation. By the rules of science, it's free to do so. See, they're much, much freer now. There's a lot of good books on this. I have a lot, but I think the most helpful one to get you into the picture easily came out in 85, I think. Yes, it was 85, called The Dancing Lee Masters by a very good physical science, no, first published in 1979, and by Gary Zukav, called The Dancing Womb Masters, but the one, the sensation today, the big seller today, as you may know, is Stephen Hawking's book, A Short History of Time. And of course they go right together. This brings it a little more up to date. This is a little more condensed. It's very condensed. You might find it more difficult to understand, though both books are quite lucid. And these are some of the things. These are the basic theses now that come out in the new quantum science. The first is, we used to make it a modest confession to say, well, I'm going to suggest Zukav's book because it's in paperback and it's still at the bookstore. And by Wu Li, he means The Dancing Wu Li Masters. Wu Li is the Chinese word for science, science masters. And so, the modest confession used to be we don't know everything. The modest confession today is we don't know anything. This is a very important position to take. Here, of course, it begins with thoughts. And it's more now than just a rhetorical statement. The dilemma we're talking about, the great Heisenberg here, who gave us the uncertainty principle. The dilemma of having to talk in classical terms, our usual positivistic language, about phenomena which cannot be described in classical concepts, is the basic paradox of quantum mechanics. It pervades every part of it. It's like trying to explain an LSD experience. We try to use familiar concepts as points of departure. You say a hat is a hat, and that's that, and that's science. You see, that doesn't go anymore. We try to use familiar concepts, nobody wears hats for one thing, to use familiar concepts as points of departure, but beyond that, the familiar concepts do not fit the phenomena. The alternative is to say nothing at all. Physicists who deal with quantum theory, says Heisenberg, are also compelled to use a language taken from ordinary life. They're compelled to. We act as if there really were such a thing as an electric current, for example, or a particle. Because if we forbade all physicists to speak of electric currents or particles, they could no longer express their thoughts. But they know there are no such things, but they have to call it something. That's a thing that St. Augustine says. What did he say? Impar. Yeah, sed imago. That's very good. He gives a picture of Jesus as having a body and so forth. And he says that's incorrect. Impar sed imago. He says it's incorrect, but it's at least a picture. Now I'll give you a picture of this thing so you'll understand it. You see, I say this is a kangaroo. And I show you a picture of a rake and say that's a kangaroo. I say, well, that's not a kangaroo, but you have to understand that way. That's what they say when they talk about things in theology, impar sed imago. It's not what I'm talking about, but it's at least something to think about, something, an image to think about. And so when they paint a picture of the Father with a dove over his head and Mary on one side and Christ on the other and radiant lights coming out around them and so forth, people are prone to think of those as being physical beings. They say, oh, no, they're not physical. They're just pictures to give you an idea. But if you want a person to get an idea of what a thing is not, you don't draw a picture of something else, do you, and say, that's it. It's the best possible way to confuse, you see, if he's not that. All over southern Germany, they have these magnificent crossroads. Go back to the Middle Ages, they have these magnificent crucifixes. And on the bottom, it says, Jesus nicht ein Götze, den wir anbeten. This is not an idol that we're praying to, just to remind you that it looks like one. If it looks like an elephant, call it an elephant, you see. But this is not an idol that we're praying to. Danger on bed. Also, but we have to call it that because there's nothing else to call it that. You can see that's going to lead to trouble. But that's the game that the theologians have always been playing. They're always talking about Father, Son, Holy Ghost, Christology, and so forth, terms that they are beyond our mysteries, beyond understanding, and we just have to use those terms. What could be plainer than the word Father or the word Son? They're the most elementary, primitive family words you could get. And if you want to say that God is not our Father and Christ is not a literal Son, then why on earth can't you find some other words or better words to use than the very words that would lead people straight to the wrong conclusion? So he says, therefore, physicists talk about subatomic particles as if they were little objects leaving tracks in a bubble changer and have an independent objective existence. That's not true at all. This convention has been extremely productive. Over the last 40 years, almost 100 particles have been discovered. They constitute what Kenneth Ford calls the particle zoo. But the particle zoo, none of those particles exist in reality. You go, this is a strange thing. But then that's so in our normal relationships. A German philosopher, late 19th century, by the name of Hans Vaihinger, wrote a famous work called Die Philosophie des Als Ob, The Philosophy of the As If, showing that we couldn't get along if we weren't just play acting. Havelock Ellis wrote a book the same way in English called The Dance of Life. We're all play acting, we're all making believe, we're all sort of skating around this way. We're certainly doing it today more than ever before. And for example, he gives Vaihinger, a person writes a letter, you're right, if you don't pay me the money you owe me, I'll have the law on you. Signed, your obedient and humble servant. Well, that's the as if, see, in order to get along, we make all these assumptions as if. Our whole, well, the whole market, the stock market goes on the presumption of as if certain things were so, as if this paper, as if the computer was giving us reality or something. But if we can't, we have as if it gets along very smoothly. It smooths the rails, and you may act as if a person is your friend, you get along better that way. But we're starting, but we really don't know what's there, is the point here, and so he tells us here in, they always keep coming back to this. This is the fundamental thing, and it says not just in a philosophical, abstract, scientific way, we really don't know what the universe is like. In the middle 1900s, Newtonian mechanics was at its zenith. There seemed to be no phenomena which could not be explained in terms of mechanical models. All models were subject to long-established rules. The chairman of the physics department at Harvard discouraged graduate students because so few important matters remained undesolved. And then Lord Kelvin in 1900 thought there were two little clouds in there, and those clouds grew, and by 1927, the foundation of the new physics, mechanical relativity were in place. And finally, in contrast to Kelvin's time, the allegiance of physicists today is to a symbol of extreme openness. That's the model. You can believe almost anything to start for a basis for experiment, for a basis of speculation. Nothing is too wild. It's extreme openness. A famous saying of Heisenberg when somebody introduced a theory at a conference and they said, that's pretty wild, wasn't it? And he said, no, the only trouble is it crazy enough? This is the thing. Reality, the man says, is what we take to be true. What we take to be true is what we believe. What we believe is based on our perceptions. What we perceive depends on what we look for. What we look for depends on what we think. What we think depends on what we perceive. What we perceive determines what we believe. What we believe determines what we take to be true. Of course, we're just going around and around here. What we take to be true is our reality, and we're stuck with that. But that's not the reality. That's the world we live in here. Now, the critics of Mormonism have always proclaimed, remember, that they're cool, detached, impartial observers. Now, that's a very basic theme today. There is no such thing as an observer, a detached observer observing detached things. This is the idea now. What you look at is something else. We don't analyze it. The famous Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. It does say that it is not like the reality is not like it appears. It says, what we perceive to be physical reality is actually our cognitive construction of it. You make it, and that's all. This cognitive construction may appear to be substantive and real, but the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics leads directly to the conclusion that the physical world itself is not a substantive reality here. They met in in 1901 was in Copenhagen. A lot of top scientists came to that conclusion. Einstein opposed it for a while, and well, there's a different thing. But here we've got 82 and 280 here. Another statement of that. These statements are rather important, something I think. I've always actually had an influence on me. Yeah, here. Von Neumann's discovery that our thought processes, the realm of symbols, project illusory restrictions into the real world. It's essentially the same discovery that Einstein made to the general theory of relativity. Einstein disproved the universality of Euclidean geometry, the most obvious thing. That was the final proof. I remember when I was a kid, I was reading a book on geometry, and Vern Knudsen, who was the head of the physics department at UCLA at that time, oh, I was 13 or so, he came to the house for dinner at that time. He was a member of the church, so in the wards we got together, and he saw the grammar, which is a very old-fashioned geometry, but he says, now there you have reality, that is the final reality. When you have something proved there, you know it is true. You can't go farther than that, you see. That's what it was in those days. And it was an projection, illusory restriction to the real world. It's essentially the same discovery that Einstein made. He disproved the universality of that geometry I was doing there, that Euclidean geometry. Until the general theory of relativity, Euclidean geometry had been accepted without question as the underlying structure of the universe. Birkhoff and von Neumann disproved the universality of classical logic. That's part of it. See, not only the logic on which it's based, but the logic itself, classical logic, based on the excluded middle and basic terms. Aristotle, you see, a thing can't be A and B at the same time. That's out now. You forget about your excluded middle. It can be A and B and a lot of other things. Birkhoff von Neumann disproved the universality of classical logic. Until now, classical logic has been accepted without question as natural reflection of the nature of reality, and it's nothing of the sort. A powerful awareness lies dormant in these discoveries, an awareness of the hitherto unsuspected powers of the mind to mold reality. You can make it up. Rather than the other way around. In this sense, the philosophy of physics is becoming indistinguishable from the philosophies of Buddhism, which is the philosophy of enlightenment, and the only difference between Buddhism and Mormonism there is that Buddhism is complete annihilation. Don't ask for anything and you won't be disappointed. They're going to be they're so realistic to say that there really is nothing. Nyeti nyeti is where it all ends up, just exactly like Jerome into the nothing from which he came. But we in the Egyptians say, you have to be yourself and you'll always be yourself. Well, then, and whatever sense we make of the scene, it would seem, is quite wrong today. Here's another one. I like these quotations. Here, as soon as we start criticizing, what this comes down to is the idea, did the Lord really come? Is that possible? And I am in a position to judge, you see. Bell's theorem shows that common ideas are inadequate, even to describe the macroscopic events of the everyday world. We're not just talking about particles here, little dinky things, but the things that happen all around us. It shows that our ordinary ideas about the world are somehow profoundly deficient, even on the macroscopic level, even the level of books and papers and things like that. Profoundly deficient. They won't work at all. No matter how it is formulated, it projects irrational aspects of subatomic phenomena squarely into macroscopic domain. It's not just the subatomic, it's the world we live in. It says not only do events in the realm of the very small behave in ways that are utterly different from our common sense view of the world, but also that events of the world at large, the world of freeways and sports cars, behave in ways which are utterly different from our common sense view of them. You've got a completely cockeyed view of the world. The incredible statement cannot be dismissed as fantasy because it's based on the awesome and proven accuracy of quantum theory itself. So what have we got here? This is your turn. Then we see something. What is it we see? We see the part that appeals to us. Well, then what do we do? We have to construct our own universe, and this is a thing that's become very prominent since, well, biological science. Did any particles at all exist before we thought about them and measured them? Did they exist before we thought of them? The answer is, did we create the particles that we are experimenting with? Incredible as it sounds, this is the possibility that many physicists recognize. John Wheeler, a well-known physicist at Princeton, wrote, May the universe in some strange sense be brought into being by the participation of those who participate, that you bring it into being, you bring your type. Well, it's not just your part, not just your sensation, but there must be something out there that's giving it to you, and you influence that. The vital act is the act of participation. You don't observe anymore something out there. You participate. You're a part of it. The participator, remember what the scripture says about the Lord, he is in all things and through all things and about all things. Well, every participator is that, he says here. The participator is incontrovertible new concept given by quantum mechanics. It strikes down the term observer of classical theory, the man who stands safely behind the thick glass wall and watches what goes on without taking part in it. That won't go. It can't be done, quantum mechanics says. When you observe, you enter into it, and you're in it and through it and about it in the same way, too. Then we can't see it all, so we insist on filling out the picture, because we have to have a complete picture. We can't just leave it there. You see how that would... That's what I used to call the gas law of learning. The gas law is that any amount of gas, no matter how small, will fill any vacuum, no matter how large. Well, even though only two atoms, you see. Well, any amount of ignorance, no matter how great, can be satisfied and filled by any amount of knowledge, no matter how small. If I'm a complete ignoramus and I learn two facts, I'm happy now. I know. I'm a knower. You find that all the time, of course. No matter how great the ignorance, just a few facts will fill it up all right. But this is an interesting statement here where he says, whether something is true or not is not a matter of how it corresponds to absolute truth, but how it's consistent with our experience. Well, those people really saw the Savior, see? The extraordinary importance of the Copenhagen interpretation lies in that for the first time, scientists attempting to formulate a consistent physics were forced by their own findings to acknowledge that a complete understanding of reality lies beyond the capabilities of rational thought. We'll never have a complete understanding of reality. In other words, there'll always be mysteries, you can put it that way. It was this that Einstein could not accept. The most incomprehensible thing about the world, he wrote, is that it is comprehensible. Is it comprehensible? That thought is incomprehensible, he says. But the deed was done. The new physics was based upon, not upon absolute truth, but upon us. Acknowledge that a complete understanding of reality lies beyond the capabilities of rational thought. So we should be able to accept all sorts of things here. And 192, what he says here, I just marked some of them. No physicist, not even Planck himself, wanted to accept this idea, the implication of Planck's discovery. For to do so threatened the scientific structure, the Newtonian physics, over 300 years old. Heisenberg wrote about the quantum revolution. This is how we react to it. When new groups of phenomena compel changes in patterns of thought, this goes especially in theology, a person says he's had a vision, and what's the reaction to it? When new groups of phenomena compel changes in patterns of thought, even the most eminent physicists find immense difficulties. For the demand for change in thought patterns may engender a feeling that the ground is being pulled from under one's feet. I believe that the difficulties at this point can hardly be overestimated. Once one has experienced the desperation with which clever and conciliatory men of science react to the demand for a change in the thought pattern, one can only be amazed that such revolutions in science have actually been possible at all. Because whenever they take place, nobody wants to be to tear out all the plumbing and redo it all again. That's what it amounts to, you see, or be pulled out of a nice warm bed and a cold shower or something like that. Nobody wants that. It's terrible. They fight. They hang on to this furniture. They cling. They scream and everything else, and it finally goes through. Well, you can imagine what their action would be to Joseph Smith in a case like that, trying to introduce them into another world. They acted accordingly. They were absolutely frantic where that went. So we insist on filling out the picture here and making one that we can see. Can this be achieved here? Yeah. Now, this is one. We have these ideas that don't get along together, and you end up, and this is a very serious thing, with the many worlds concept. Many worlds that are just alike, and that's an important thing, yes. The many worlds, here we have it, see. If the second assumption, then we are led to the many worlds theory, in which the world continuously splitting up into separate and mutual inaccessible branches, each of which contains different editions of the same actors performing different acts at the same time. So like this world, there are other worlds with actors going on, not doing the same things we are, but they're contemporary with our particular world, as far as that goes. This is the many world theory, which is Yeah, it becomes crowded because it's necessary to fulfill certain things all at once, you see. Despite the tidal wave of knowledge which has swept over us for 40 years recently, the fundamental physics group found it necessary, like physicists at Copenhagen half a century before them, to acknowledge that it might not be possible to construct a mode of reality at all. You'll never be able to know the real world exists. This acknowledgement is more than a recognition of the limitations of this theory or that theory. It is a recognition emerging throughout the West, and he underlines this, that knowledge itself is limited. We can only have so much knowledge in this world. There's a lot going on that we'll never go on behind. We don't realize that. It's easy to say, well, I don't know everything, and all sorts of things are possible, and so forth. But when it comes to criticism, when it talks about the things of the eternities and the possibilities, what brings this on, you see, is this interruption, this breaking in, the Lord breaking in and appearing, the angel Moroni coming. If they're going to do things like that, then you say, well, they must be crazy. No. We might not, it might be possible for us to construct a model of reality. This acknowledgement is more than a recognition of limitations, a recognition that throughout the West, growing now today throughout the West, that knowledge itself is limited. Said in another way, it is recognition of the difference between knowledge and wisdom. So we have the word wisdom here. And then, so much for the common sense cold light of day theory. I think it's an important one here too, yes. The either or, I said the excluded middle and the like. The wave particle was marked either or, a way of looking at it. So physicists no longer would accept the proposition that light is either a particle or either a wave, because they had proved to themselves that it was both, depending on how they looked at it. And this opens the door to all sorts of things. It meant a tendency for something. It was a qualitative, this is what Heisenberg wrote. It was a quantitative version of the old concept of potentia in Aristotelian philosophy, potentialities. You have all these potentialities, and you have them every day of your life. You see, every second of your life you have to make a choice. That's why this is the time of judgment. That's why this is the time when we're being tested. Which will you choose? The doctrine of the two ways. It isn't the doctrine of two ways. You once had a choice 10 years ago. Every hour of your life, you have a choice of which way, as the Book of Mormon says, to go. Of the two ways. So you're being judged. And which do you judge? Which do you choose? You decide for yourself. So there you are. I say it's like a child who's lucid in a candy store or a toy shop. Or we'll say in a cavern of jewels. You're let loose in a cavern of jewels. You can have any jewel you want in here. There's your potentialities. They're all available to you. But you can choose only one. And when you've chosen one, then your other choices are all out. A lot is being said about that today by these physics people. You have these potentialities. He says, this is the way Heisenberg puts it, these potentia. It introduced something standing in the middle between the idea of an event and the actual event, a strange kind of physical reality just in the middle between possibility and reality. I think of the Savior standing there, a strange type of reality just in the middle between possibility and reality. But you must make your choice and decide, and when the apostle decided they'd believe, there he was, as far as that was concerned. But they had to decide, and you have to, and you don't make a thing cease to exist just because you don't believe in it. So that's what it says at all. Well, here's another good one. In a related context, Niels Bohr wrote, "The quantum mechanics, in essence, entails the necessity of a final renunciation of the classical idea of causality, a radical revision of our attitude toward the problem of physical reality." See, our fatalism, I had a brother who was a passionate fatalism. Well, of course, Aristotle's that, because one thing causes another, therefore you're not to blame for anything. What caused you to do this was caused. Something else caused him to do that, and something else caused that to happen. You're back and you're the helpless victim of chain of causality. But he says, we're not have that anymore. The final renunciation of classical idea of causality, they give that up. Radical revision of our attitude to physical reality. Well, what do you have in place of that, you see, this man? Well, let's see, you've got something 126 here. Yes, the entire structure of classical mechanics was based on the fact that somewhere, somehow, there must be a frame of reference in which the laws of classical mechanics were valid. The inability of physicists to find it made classical mechanics appear like a huge castle built on the sand. That's the basic mechanics we've been working with ever since. And so we're like, our view is hopelessly limited, and we say that's reality. Remember in Hamlet, when he sees the ghost, he sees his father's ghost comes to him, and he's with his mother, Gertrude. And he says, don't you see it? He says, what do you see? She says, nothing at all, yet all that is I see. Well, the nothing at all was true. She didn't see anything. But when she adds, but all that is I see, there was the catch. Do you see all there is, you see? But all there is. So we have here, the general rule of relativity shows that our minds follow different rules than the real world does. A rational mind, based on the impressions that it receives from limited perspective, like our Gertrude, forms structures which thereafter determine what it further will and will not accept freely. What you accept after that must fit into the structure you've built up. From that point on, regardless of how the real world actually operates, this rational mind, following its self-imposed rules, very reasonable, tries to superimpose on the real world its own version of what must be. See, I've decided what I will see, and I will see that, and that's it, see. You can't have seen that because such things don't exist. The limited perspective is the perspective of our three-dimensional rationality in view of one small part of the universe, the part into which we were born. The things that must be are our ideas of geometry, the rules governing straight lines, circles, triangles, and so forth. The beginner's mind was Albert Einstein's mind, who started very differently. The long-held belief that these rules govern without exception the entirety of the universe. But Einstein's beginner's mind realized that this is just not so. It's only so in our minds. However, as our experience expands, we encounter more and more difficulty trying to superimpose these rules on the entire expanse of the universe. Einstein was the first person to see that the geometrical rules which apply to one small part of the universe, as seen from limited perspective like ours, are not universal. This freed him to behold the universe in a way no person had seen it before. And so it's called that wide open thing that anything goes today. Well, these are S-161. The light of common day. Then, so these things related how? They're infinite worlds, but in no local, there are no local causes. We talk about the other world and so forth, and how the Lord can get around and all this sort of thing. This is one thing that Galileo already pointed out, and he could have made Einstein's discovery because he had it already. And Newton was the one who pointed out that Galileo had pointed out, namely this. Say you have two worlds, the Lord, in other words, have two worlds, and they're 50 light years apart. And light is C, it's the constant. Nothing can go faster than light. Absolutely nothing can go faster than light. But you have Newton's line. It completely baffled Newton. He said there was no explanation to it all. But you say these worlds move farther apart or closer together. Well, then the gravitational force between them changes. According to the rule, you see proportional mass and inversely proportional to the square of the distance. So even if they move a little bit, the force between them changes. But they're 50 light years apart. Does it take 50 years for that rule to apply? No, it instantly applies. Well, how can it? They're 50 light years apart. Nothing can travel faster than light. And yet, it doesn't take 5 minutes. If they just move 5 feet apart, according to Newton's rule, of course, they'll change just like that. And they will change instantaneously. And so throughout the world, we have these instantaneous communication everywhere. It goes everywhere. This is why gravity doesn't fit into the complete rule. You know, the rule is supposed to answer all. There are the three forces, but they can't get the fourth force, which is gravity. Because gravity doesn't. The other rules, the other three forces, the heavy, the strong, the weak, and the electromagnetic, they all follow the basic rule of the constant C. But gravity will have nothing to do with constancy. It works no matter what, no matter how far apart, instantaneous and so forth, that there are instantaneous connections in the universe, do things like that. Well, let me see, I have a juicy one here. These infinite worlds and local causes, they talk a lot about now in this 296. I'm glad they explain these so clearly. It's all over my head. The principle of local causes, I mean, something happens in this world and something happens in this world that have nothing to do with each other. No, the thing we hear today is whatever happens in one is going to influence all the others. What's his name was right. When he said that James Jeans was right, when he said every time, of course this is absurd, every time a baby throws his bottle out of the perambulator, he disturbs the orbit of the remotest star. Well, not drastically, you understand. The idea of that connection is there. Well, but the principle of local cause is that thing can happen anywhere without influencing something else. That's out. The principle of local causes must be false. Then, hence, the world is not the way it appears to be. Then what must be the true nature of the world? He says, there are no separate parts in the universe. In this picture, what happens here, now we think of Christ coming, that he's being there and so forth, he's going to see them tomorrow, how long will it take and so forth. This picture, what happens here, is intimately and immediately connected with what happens everywhere else in the universe, which in turn is intimately and immediately connected with what happens elsewhere in the universe, and so on, simply because separate parts of the universe are not separate parts. This is very strong stuff. So when you hear in temple or elsewhere that all truth can be circumscribed in one great whole, it's all one family. There, we know, we say there are worlds without number. We read that from the Pearl of Great Price. There are worlds without number, and how can they all act together? And how can the Lord get around to all of them at once? Well, this immediately raises problems which to us are quite baffling at present, but they sort of thaw out when you start thinking in terms like this. Thus, one is led to a new notion of an unbroken wholeness which denies the classical idea of analyzing the world into separate and independent existing parts. You don't have separate existing parts, we're just one. It's one big whole thing and we're all connected. So we're not going to get out of it. So the scripture says, until you've paid the last farthing, you're not going to be able to get out of the house because there's no way of getting out. We're all shut into it in the same one. We've all got to live together forever. And you're all ever so close and so intimate according to all this. But I wanted to get into Hawking's book. He's really exciting, but two things. It's more condensed and it's over my head.